Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the excellent engineer, Ed Stasium. But first, I want to talk to you about giving your music away. Artists have been giving their music away going all the way back to Frank Sinatra, and probably going back to Caruso, for that matter. A prominent music attorney in Los Angeles once told me that almost all major artists make the majority of their money from everything but music sales, and that percentage goes anywhere from 90% to 96%. So that means only about 4% of what a major artist makes is from selling their music. In fact, they've been giving away their music pretty much forever on the radio. Remember that artists don't get paid for their music playing on the radio. Songwriters do, but the artists don't. We're the only country that doesn't pay our artists for radio play. Other countries do, but that's because the broadcasters have a tremendously strong lobby effort going on in Washington. That aside, you have to treat your music as your marketing, because that's what it is. That's the gateway that will open things up for you to be able to sell other products and go on tour. If you don't do that, if you don't have a marketing plan that is built around your music, then there's no way to get exposed to people. So your music is your marketing. And this brings us to something called the economies of free. The economies of free basically says there's two types of products. There's the infinite product and there's a scarce product. Now, what that means is there's product that is so easy to attain that you give it away, which is your music. So think about it like this. Digital music is very easily pirated right now. It's very easy to get online. It's very easy to go to YouTube and get your music. It's very easy to go to a streaming network and get your music, even though you do get paid a little bit for that. But in general, what you're trying to do is give that product away. And in turn, you want to charge for the scarce products. What are scarce products? Well, playing live. There's only one of you to go around, so that's pretty scarce. Other scarce products would be, of course, merchandise. Merchandise is a lot less scarce, but nonetheless, it is a scarce commodity. But you could make it even more scarce by having things like numbered items. So in other words, it's one of 1,000, one of 500. That makes it very scarce. Giving away backstage pass, giving away a pass to the recording studio where someone can come and see you in action in a rehearsal recording studio. These things are scarce items, and these things are the things that you could charge money for and actually get people to pay for. While your music is harder and harder and harder to have people pay for it. So don't even worry about it. Just give it away. Because musicians have been doing it, artists have been doing it forever. If you get too close to it and think that you want to charge for it, the problem is you may make a few sales, but you're going to limit your marketing. You're going to limit your visibility, ultimately. And this goes for most artists. At a certain point, artists can begin to charge for their music, but it takes a long time till they get to that point. And even then, you see all the major artists basically give it away. If they get radio play, they're giving it away. So don't be afraid to give your music away. Your music is your marketing. Next thing I want to talk about is a production budget. Many young producers don't know how to design a production budget. And really, there's 8 questions that you should ask before you design this budget. First thing is, how many songs are going to be recorded? The more songs, the more time it'll take, and the more it will cost. What format will the project be released in? Is it digital only? Well, it's going to cost a whole lot less than if it's going to be released on a CD, or if it's going to be released on vinyl, or DVD, or anything that is a hard copy of something, a physical copy. So that's another thing to ask. What format will the project be released in? Is manufacturing included in the budget? So is manufacturing for the physical product, is that included in the budget? So if you have a budget of $10,000, let's say, we'll just pick it out of thin air. If you have to spend $2,000 of that on CDs, that means your recording budget is only $8,000, so you have to know that up front. Does the project include mastering? Once again, mastering can be a big cost depending on who you go to. So for instance, if you go to an A-list mastering engineer, it could cost anywhere between $1,500 and $5,000 for the mastering of your project. And if that's not included in the budget, that's okay. If it is included, you want to know that up front because that's another hit on your budget that you should know about. What kind of sound does the artist want? Does the artist want an intimate sound or a big studio type sound? Does he or she want you to go to the record plant, for instance, or to an ocean way where it has big rooms so the whole band can play at the same time? Well, of course, that costs more money doing that. Does the artist really care if you're in a smaller studio or a home studio where you can just do one instrument at a time or you're limited to one instrument at a time? Once again, that impacts your budget, so you have to know about it. Does the budget include your fee, which is really important? So in other words, you may charge X amount of dollars for your fee. And hopefully you're getting paid if you're doing a production project, getting paid something at least. Well, is that part of the budget? Because once again, that could be another hit on your budget. If you say you have $10,000 and there's $1,500 going to you and $1,500 going to mastering and $2,000 going to manufacturing, well, guess what? That means the budget's only really $5,000 for recording and mixing. So you have to know these things up front. The last thing is, an artist always has a budget in mind, or whoever is financing the project. They always have a figure that they're comfortable with. They might not say it. They might say something like, how much is this going to cost? But the fact of the matter is, in their minds, they know what they're going to be comfortable with. So you might as well ask up front, what budget do you have in mind? What would make you feel good? And work around it from there. Because you might be surprised. It might be a bigger budget than you would ask for. Or on the other hand, if it's a smaller budget, at least you can negotiate up. But that way you'll also keep the job, because if you give a budget that's way beyond what someone is expecting to pay, chances are they may get scared and think you cost too much and go on to someone else. So this way, if you say, what budget do you have in mind, you have a chance of at least coming in within the realm of reason to whoever's paying for the project. This is all different when it comes to a record label, by the way, because a record label will tell you up front how much they have for the budget. But in these days that we live in, most projects are funded independently, and there's fewer and fewer label deals out there and fewer label budgets. So those are the 8 things that you should know before you begin to put together a production budget. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I love to read your questions and comments, so keep them coming. My guest today is engineer Ed Stasium, who's engineered some of the greatest guitar records ever and some of my favorites, which includes artists like the Ramones, Living Color, the Smithereens, Mick Jagger, as well as Talking Heads and Joe Strummer and Big Audio Dynamite and many, many more. I talked to Ed from his studio near San Diego via Skype. So, Ed, thank you for being with me today.
It's good to be here, Bobby. It's
always a pleasure. When I think of Ed Stasium, I always think of great guitar records. The Ramones, Smithereens, Living Color, the Mick Jagger record you did, just great guitar sounds. So what's your secret?
Follow your instinct. I don't think there is a secret. I don't have any secrets. I don't have any rules. I just put up the microphones and go for it. There is no secret, Bobby.
Yeah.
You can do it too. You know, it's all in the player. I've always believed that. Johnny Ramone turned everything up to 10. Everything. Toot, all the way down the line. And, I just put a couple mics up. I do have room sound. I think that in reviewing your question, going back to my time spent in Atlas Studio More in Heights, working with Roy Thomas Baker, introduced me to using room sounds, which, learning by myself in a studio in New Jersey, I had no idea about, using ambient microphones. And when I got back from the studio to, start working with Leave Home, I started using room mics on the guitars. And I always use, I also always have, people just put microphones on the amplifier. Mm-hmm. I've always put one at ear level. I instead of just putting, you know, just a microphone right up on the speaker, I'll have a room mic. You know, these days, you know, I'll use three or four mics on a guitar. And I have for quite a few years.
That's a great idea, though, at ear level.
Ear level. That's where you hear the amps from. I always put a microphone. I have this old, my favorite one for that microphone. I found a RCA. What is that microphone? It's the predecessor to the 44, P39. Darn. I don't remember the name of it. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a good old ribbon mic, and I had AEA. I found that at a garage sale in Sherman Oaks, California, in the 80s for $5. Ugh. And it said it had a tag on it over the it said Allied Recording in New York. And when I unscrewed the little screws that are hanging on the tag, it had the RCA, you know, the RCA brass label on it. It was great.
Oh man!
And I hung on to it for years, and boy, probably in the, I bought it in the 80s, probably in the late 80s, when I sent it off to AEA to get it, you know, fixed up, get the ribbon working again. So, you know, ear level, have a room mic, and, you know, boom. And it's the player, you know, it's the sound of the guitar player.
Yeah, but even so, what you do, your records, the guitar is up in your face. I mean, it's something that you can't ignore. And yet, there's a lot of layered guitars, but you can hear them all. They all fit in, which is great.
Oh, thanks. You know, I double track. I've always double tracked a lot. And I was always very precise with double tracking to make sure it was spot on. So you don't, if you even have it in the center or you have it left and right, I like it to be spot on. There's a difference between double tracking and a delay, as you well know. I just had a friend of mine sent me an email the other day, asked me what I thought of the idea of double tracking as opposed to using ADT, the automatic double tracking business that the fellows at Abbey Road came up with. And you know, I prefer double tracking because of the imperfections. So even though, getting back to the guitar, with the imperfections and in the double tracking and get it as close as you can, it gives it that wide, I just love the sound of it. It emphasizes the guitar and it sticks out. I don't know if that's what you mean.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Whatever it is, it certainly works. That's for sure. I want to talk to you about Gladys Knight, because I know you worked a lot on that. And was that your first hit, the Midnight Train to Georgia?
Yeah, it was. It was. We recorded Midnight Train, the tracking, and at Tony Camillo's place in Hillsborough, New Jersey. So it was the third attempt at doing the track, and Gladys didn't like the first two. So we did the backing track at Tony Camillo's place, and Gladys liked the third one. And it was actually, the first two were with the full-on band. Tony Camillo always had all the players. We had like one, we had the drummer, you know, Andrew Smith or Alan Schwartzberg, and Bob Babbitt played bass.
From the Funk Brothers, so geez.
Yeah. You know, Babbitt's great. Tony Camillo brought these guys out to New Jersey from Detroit, and they were like the house band. So we had cut it twice with the full band. We had three guitar players, you know, two electric piano, acoustic piano, Bobby Babbitt, and sent it off to Gladys, and she didn't like it. So the third try, we just did it with basically Andrew Smith, Bob Babbitt, Jeff Mironoff, and Tony Camillo. Just did a four-piece on a Sunday night and sent it off to her. And it was the vibe that we wanted to get, like an Al Green thing going on. And sent it off to her, and she approved of that. So, yeah, it was my first hit, to answer your question, after all that added attraction.
Where did she dialogue. Do the vocal at? Did she come to New Jersey to do the vocal?
No, we did the vocal in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
At a studio called Artie Fields.
It sounds familiar somehow.
Artie Fields Studio. And it was a one take vocal.
Huh.
It was a one take. And, you know, I was I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have any schooling. You know, I just kind of came off the street with a little bit of knowledge of tape recorders and music, and didn't even get a chance to get a level on her She just said, it was basically, I'm going to go out and sing right now. And okay, go out and sing. So I don't even remember what kind of console it was. I just basically guessed, you know, I'm sure I had an LA-2A on there, and guessed at the level, at the attenuation, and she went and sang, and it was a one-take vocal. It was pretty amazing.
But that's the way it was with a lot of those old performers, those older artists, because they were classic, I should say, rather than older. They were so good because they performed all the time.
It was great. You know, you listen to those records that Sinatra made, anything that was, you know, done in the 50s, the early 50s, you know, the Capitol Studio stuff, late 50s, you know, Sinatra, Nat King Cole, Dean Martin, all those cats, you know, the Rat Pack guys. Those are fantastic recordings. They sound great and the performances are great. They're all live.
Yeah.
Just live. You know, it's, you know, I don't want to diss anything that's going on in the music industry today, but, you know, I truly miss that.
Well, but again, you had that farm system because there were so many clubs to play at to learn your craft, and you could do it a lot, and that just doesn't exist anymore. And I think that's really hurt the quality of players, of certain players anyway. I've found that, you know, it's easier to get someone to play to a click because they grow up to it now, so that's easier. But on the other hand, to get the feel from someone is way different, especially a vocalist.
Yeah, and you know, boy, now you go out there and just get the vocalist to go out there and it's not one take, you do 20 takes and then you comp it.
And that's painful, isn't it?
It can be. I had a painful experience last year, about March of 2013. It was so painful. I said, I'm taking a sabbatical for a while. Seriously.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah.
It was very painful. And, you know, some rock singers that had to do a lot of comping and even punching in like a word at a time because the comping, you know, you do 20 tracks of something and it still sounds, all those tracks sound bad. So, you know, I'm not one for using a lot of that vocal tuning. So I try to get a performance.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I don't mind tuning, you know, a word or two, but that's about it.
Yeah.
So it's funny because, so you went from Gladys Knight, and then all of a sudden you started to do all of this hard rock stuff. And then you had a period where you did like new wave stuff with Joe Strummer and Big Audio Dynamite and Talking Heads. It's a big, big change there. So how did that happen? Was it just that it came to you? Did you go looking for whatever was hot at the time or what? How did that work?
No, I never put myself out there. I never looked. I never went to the clubs. I just sort of relied on my reputation. It just being at the right place at the right time. You know, I left Venture Sound in New Jersey. That's where we did the Gladys stuff. And I saw an ad. I went to the AES show in November of 75. I went to AES show. I picked up a copy of DB magazine. And in the back of DB magazine, there was an ad. Engineer wanted for La Studio Morin Heights. And, you know, I had always been a big fan of Trident Studios and all the material that was coming out of there. And they had a Trident console. It was the only Trident console in North America at the time.
What was it, an A-range?
It was an A-range.
Oh,
was,
man.
Yeah, one of the 13. And the first one in North America. So I called up. I talked to Andre Perry, who was actually the engineer. He recorded Give Peace a Chance
at
the hotel room in Montreal. And went up and took a pile of the records that I had done up to that point. You know, I'd only started 3 years earlier. A bunch of records under my arm and went up there and they made me lunch and dinner and played them the records. And I was hired on the spot and went up there. It was great. It was beautiful, beautiful place. And that took me out of my environment here. I got to work on a lot of French Canadian projects. Got to hang out while the Bee Gees were doing Children of the World and that Saturday Night Fever stuff.
Wow.
Which was real cool. And when I was up there and I came back, Alan Schwartzberg, the drummer, the New York session drummer, was a good friend of mine. And he was doing what was called a one-to-one telethon. Geraldo Rivera had done an expose of a place called Willowbrook. And it was a place where handicapped children mentally handicapped children were put when they couldn't be taken care of in a normal home situation. It was called one-to-one, and there were deplorable conditions at this place. So Geraldo got on this big bandwagon, and he had a telethon. He was on ABC TV in New York, and he did a big expose on this place and had these telethons for it. And he also had a Madison Square Garden concert, and all the proceeds went to benefit this Willowbrook Foundation, which contributed all the money to it. So Alan Schwarzberg called me up and says, he was in the house band. I came down from Canada while I was living in Canada, and I was the audio supervisor. And basically at that time, as you well know, it's all union at the television stations.
Yeah.
And I basically just sat behind this guy. I'm going to say sat behind this old guy, but he was probably my age.
Yeah.
It was probably how, you know, as old as I am right now,
but not
probably,
as hip.
Probably younger than me, you know.
Yeah, but not as hip, I'm sure. Right?
Not as hip, no. Yeah. And I, you know, just kind of stood behind him and say, okay, turn up the snare a little bit. And chewing on a cigar. While I was there, I bumped into my old cohort, Tony Bongiovi, I met through Tony Camello. Tony Camello and Tony Bongiovi were originally partners at Venture Sound. And the late Tommy Eardley, who just, as you well know, Tommy Ramone passed away recently, worked at Record Plant with Tony, and Tony was going to produce the next Ramones record. I had never heard of the Ramones, and Tony and Bob Walters were leaving Media Sound. Tony was on staff at Media Sound. Bob Walters was the manager of Media Sound, and I saw Tony. We hung out a little bit, and he's there like, Eddie, I'm going to build a new studio. Bob Walters, I'm going to produce this band, the Ramones. You want to produce the Ramones with me? You want to be the chief engineer at the studio? Come on. And basically convinced me to come back from Canada to start up working with Tony and Bob to start up what was to be Power Station, and also to work with Tony as what I thought was co-producer. It ended up, you know, doing my producer thing, but it was credited as engineer. And I didn't know from Adam about production points or anything like that at that point. I was a kid. And I came back and, you know, was thrown really right into that whole scene. So, you know, from Tony Camello, from the R&B stuff and Gladys up to Canada, up in Canada, again, I'll you know, reiterate that I did, you know, got to work with Roy Thomas Baker on it. He gave me a lot of insight into British recording techniques.
Yeah.
He did a band called Pilot up there. It was a record called Moorin Heights, named after the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And
did the hit come off that? It's Magic?
No, that was on the previous record. I don't know the name of the record, but it was one that Alan Parsons had produced.
Okay.
Yeah. And this was, you know, Roy came to, I don't know how he found out about the studio Moorin Heights, but he had, you know, right when he came up there, I think Bohemian Rhapsody was in the top 10. Night at the Opera had just come out. And that's what he played as a demonstration tape for the speakers at the studio. He had a, you know, quarter inch, 15 IPS copy of A Night at the Opera, and that's what he played. It just sounded amazing, and I hadn't heard it up to that point.
Yeah.
And I was like knocked out. It just sounded so amazing. It was great. So I was up there, and then, you know, Tony and Bob offered to pay me, you know, a salary to move back from Montreal and work for them, and that was in September of 76.
But Power Station was so hot then.
No, it wasn't even started yet.
It wasn't.
No, nope.
It became really hot, though.
Oh,
it was
hugely.
One of the hot places in town.
Yeah, yeah. After I left.
Oh, you're kidding.
That's true. It's true. I left, and it's funny. I left because they wouldn't lock out the place. My friend, the late Ned Lieben, had a band called Riff Raff. They were signed to Island Records. Our buddy Bob Margoloff, was the producer. And Ned wanted me to work on the project, and I wanted to. It was a rock project. I really wanted to work on it. They were starting to do a lot of jingles and those Star Wars albums with Miko Minardo, Miko's Star Wars, and Tony.
Oh, right, yeah.
And they were doing a lot of that at Power Station. We hadn't even really built a place. I mean, it was a year. I got there in '76 from Canada. And we were looking for a building. You know, I was out scouting buildings with Bob Walters. Tony was working. And finally found the place on 53rd Street. And the first thing we did there was mix the Ramones' Rocket to Russia. That was the first project ever done at that studio.
Wow.
Yeah. And there was, we had, you know, they were building, we were working at night, and they were building the studio during the day.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. They built the control room first so we could actually work in there.
Yeah.
And it was all floated, and they would do the construction in the room at night. And, you know, it was only Studio A at this time. There were no offices, just the control, basically just a control room and a bathroom in the place. And, you know, an overdub room. There was no plates, no reverbs. We used the stairwell. You know, Tony, Bon Jovi, and I put the speakers in there and a Crown DC-300 and a couple of 87s in the stairwell. I think with a couple of, like, a pair of JBL 4310s in there.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. On the east side of the building, there's a like a fire escape stairwell. Apparently, they can't use it anymore because of some fire regulations.
Isn't that the way that always goes, huh?
Yeah. So getting back to the story at hand, Bob Walters would not lock out the studio. So I, you know, it was very amicable. And, you know, I really wanted to do this project. So, of course, at the time, Media Sound, I was able to lock out Media Sound. We took the project over to Media. And that's when I really went independent as an engineer. Mm-hmm. I you know, worked for Camello. Then I worked at the Studio Morin Heights and then worked for Tony and Bob. Probably from 76 around, I think in winter 78, probably just a little around 2 years. And that's when I left. And as soon as I left, that's when Springsteen moved in to do the River record.
Oh,
Neil,
I see.
That Neil Dorsman engineered it. But Bob Walters wouldn't even lock it out for Springsteen. No. And it was like night sessions because their money was coming in from jingles. And during the day, they were doing jingles, all sorts of that type of thing.
Yeah.
And
that was big money back then.
Yeah. And Springsteen, they come in at midnight, you know, and work until 8, 9 in the morning. And then they would have to write everything down. They'd have to break down the entire setup and then have it set up again by midnight.
Oh.
I think Neil, I was just speaking with Neil a couple months ago, and I think it took him like, they're 18 months doing that record.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's good for the studio, that's for sure.
Yeah. And that's when it took off as being, you know, the hot place in town to be.
Yeah. Changing the subject a little bit. For some reason, mixers that come out of New York have very aggressive mixes, very aggressive sounding, and it's really distinctive. Why do you think that is?
Sheesh. I don't know, Bobby.
Now, the one thing I think, it's because of parallel compression, especially parallel compression on the drums.
Mm.
And, you know, it's something, everyone else worldwide is much more polite about things.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But it seems like, and it's less so now because everybody travels, you know, so much, but there was a point in time where if you picked up a record that was done in New York, it had a very distinct aggressive sound as compared to, you know, LA, for instance, which was a lot more timid.
Uh-huh.
But I always thought, and from all the people I talked to and watched, there was more, well, bus compression, first of all. I think you guys in New York sort of found that out first, that was a way to go.
Yeah. I didn't use bus compression, you know, until the SSL came around. And that's when I started using bus compression. But let's go back. You know, I was using, I think we even talked about this when you interviewed me for, you know, the mixing handbook that you did.
Mm-hmm.
I would always, you know, split the snare drum and the kick drum and, you know, gate it heavily and compress it heavily and bring it up next to each other. Personally, that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, you weren't the only one.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. It seemed to be something that was kind of common in that area. And that's where I learned it, too, because I came from the East Coast. And everybody seemed to have that technique. When I moved to the West Coast, I didn't see it as much.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Boy, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately for what it may be, I never got to really sit in on a lot of other people's sessions. I was always working, and I always just did what I did, and pretty much never got, I didn't get any ideas from anybody. I could never lift anything because I was always doing my own sessions. So everything that I did, I kind of picked up on my own. I mean, I started doing that compressor and gate thing back at Camello's place with Keepexes and Gain Brains.
Oh, man.
Remember those guys?
Yeah, no kidding. Jeez.
Yeah. I was using Keepex noise gates and Gain Brain compressors. And I didn't have the opportunity to really watch anybody work. I never really was an assistant. I was always just, I was thrown in. I got thrown in the water and had to swim and never looked back really. And,
so you learned all that on your own?
Yeah, pretty much. I was never, didn't do the T-boy thing, didn't do an assisting thing. Just kind of figured it out on my own.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I mean, most people figure it out poorly.
Oh, well.
I mean, it's easier now because, you know, there's books and there's courses and there's schools and everything. So, I mean, there's a lot of knowledge out there. But back when we were coming up, there wasn't. I mean, it just wasn't there.
No, I didn't even know that Berkeley existed when I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I was 22, 23 years old, you know, I didn't know. I had no idea. There were a couple, Tony Bongiovi, it's kind of a funny story. When I first started working at Tony Camello's studio, Venture Sound, Tony Bongiovi was also a partner. And he was the first person that I ever met that was it's not the first person. I did a record with Bruce Swedeen. Do we talk about this ever?
No, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. In 1971, when I was still in a rocking band called Brandywine, we got a record deal. And the reason we got a record deal was because the person that quote unquote managed us, this guy, Barry Landers, was also the publicity point person for the New York Yankees. And the owner of Brunswick Records, Nat Tarnopol, had a box seat at Yankee Stadium. And Barry just mentioned to Nat, "Hey, I'm managing this band." And Nat says, "Hey, have him come to my studio, make a record." We got signed to Brunswick Records. And we went out in July or August of 71. The bass player couldn't make it, so I actually played bass on the record as well. We drove out, myself, Chip Miles, the drummer, and Albert Miller, who was the keyboard player. And Albert and I both sang. And we went out to Brunswick Recording Studios. And they had Bruce Swedeen was the engineer. And he had a custom console there. It was done on an Ampex MM1000. And so I did get to watch Bruce work, but it was, you know, I didn't know what I was looking at. And I was really young then. I was like 20 years old, 21 years old. So I got to work with one of the greats, a couple of the greats. And so I did watch Bruce a little bit, and I had no idea what he was doing because I just you plug a microphone in and, you know, didn't know anything about compressors, didn't learn about compressors and outboard equalization or even reverb until, you know, later on. But that, when looking back, you know, working with one of the greats, you know, it's like, you know, Michael Jackson, you know, Quincy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Count Basie and Brandywine.
but what's important about that, though, I think part of it is not so much the technique, it's listening to what they're doing and getting that reference point of what sounds good and what they consider sounds good. Mm-hmm. I think that's as important as watching what the technique is. Yeah. Because if you don't have that reference point, then you don't know what really sounds good or bad.
Yeah, yeah. It was always, for me, it was always clarity, you know, no distortion and clarity. Making that was always very important to me, even with my little, you know, Sony 630, you know, quarter inch tape recorder, which I recorded all the band's demos with when I was young. That was my first tape recorder. And, you know, small dynamic mics. I made sure that, you know, sometimes if I noticed that if the mic was too close, it didn't sound good. You know, it would distort and overload. I was never one to overload anything, tape. I always kept it under the VU. Pretty crazy.
You don't use a lot of effects, do you?
I don't. No, I don't. You know, I have my little, I've always had a little bit of slap, you know, slap delay. I always had a tape delay rolling, but as far as minimal, I have them in there, but they're minimal. I like a natural sound.
So do you go more for room sound then? You're looking for more room ambience when you're recording?
Yes, now I do. Now I do, yeah. You know, so I can say since 1975, you know, the first 3 years I didn't get into the room sound. But as I mentioned earlier, with, you know, vocals, I don't use a room sound. But, you know, with drums, I found that incredibly important to use ambience instead of just the close mics on a drum.
It's really funny, Ed, because there are some people that just can't mix without, you know, tons of effects. And it's not that they do a bad job because of it, that, you know, there are some great mixers, but it almost seems like it's harder to do without the effects.
Mm.
To me, you know, when I look at it, it's like, wow, you made it sound that good, and yet you didn't really do anything in terms of, you know, adding any of the secret sauce at the end, except for what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, you know, I just try to make it sound how I think it's. I have no preconceived notions, really. I just try to make it sound good. That's...
Well, again, you know, it's all in the ears, and that's the big part of it. Now, the interesting thing is, so now you grew up in New York, grew up in the studios in New York, and you're used to mixing on all sorts of consoles, and now you don't do that. Now you mix in the box, and you were one of the first to actually do that, to be able to make that transition very easily. So what was the secret for you?
Necessity. I think it was, it was necessity. You know, I was doing a lot of small independent projects, and it was necessary to, you know, do it at home. I didn't have budgets to go into a major studio. And, you know, when did I pick up Pro Tools? Boy, 1999, 2000, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And, just applied all of my knowledge of working in the studios up to that point to make it just sound like as I like it in Pro Tools.
Do you find it limiting?
I find it, no, I don't find it limiting. You know, I've come into it to be my little buddy. You know, I really enjoy working in Pro Tools. I like the advantages of being able to recall at a moment's notice. You know, I don't have a big old SSL and, you know, interns and to set up a recall, you know, and recalls, as you well know, you know, when I did do any recalls back in the day, you know, it would take 3 hours to patch all that outboard stuff in,
yeah,
and, you know, do all the knobs and this business. And fortunately at that time I was working with an assistant that would do that, but they, you know, as well as I do, Bobby, that, you know, those recalls, they never came back the same.
Yep. That's for sure.
Never, ever, 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 ever. And now they come back exactly the same, don't they?
Yeah, you know, I found it really painful to have to do that. And there are two things for me back in the console era that really kind of bugged me. And, you know, of course, recall was one of them. It was like, man, there has to be a better way than that. And the second thing was the automation. I never liked the automation. And now it's brilliant because you can just go in, if you want to, you can draw it in. Which,
oh, yeah.
I find, you know, better in many cases. And
oh,
it's simpler, you know?
I certainly do. I certainly do. And now it's easy for me to work on several projects simultaneously.
Yeah.
And I do have some, you know, my chain, you know, I do everything in the box, but my output, you know, I use some analog gear on the output. I take the analog outputs of my 192, and I go into a dangerous 2 bus, and then the output of the dangerous 2 bus, I go into a DBX 160 SL compressor.
Wow.
And out of the 160 SL, I go into a pair of 5033s, the Rupert Neve Porticos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then I record it back into Pro Tools in the same session. That's what I record to. I don't go to an external tape machine or a DAT or anything. I go right back in. So I do have a little bit of recall with the EQ and the compressor.
But how much do you add though?
You know what? I'm looking at them right now, and you know these knobs haven't changed. You know, I use the same. I pretty much keep the same EQ on there for every session. It's like Ed's curve. my EQ curve is there, and it's not much. It's just a wee bit of a bit of boost and cut at certain frequencies.
A bit in the bottom and a bit in the top.
Yeah, a bit of bottom, a bit of the top, a bit of mids. You know, yeah. a bit of nothing really. People have been very happy with it, and I'm happy with it. I tend to A/B occasionally. It sounds good to me. I like it, and I can work on, like I said, several projects at one time, and the recall coming back up is just so easy to do. It's nice, and I can work at home. Don't have an SSL here. I have, I'm still running an old rig, an old Pro Tools rig.
When you mix, if you're mixing an album project, for instance, are you working on multiple songs at the same time? Do you work on something for 3 or 4 hours and then put it away and go to something else?
I don't. I'll be working on, I work on one song at a time. And I do it sparingly. I walk away from it a lot.
Yeah.
Back in the day, we had deadlines, all the records that I did back in the day, Smithereens, Living Color, Ramones, we would, finish all recording and then mix, probably in a 2 week period. I take a little bit longer now just because I just like to get away from it. I'll mix for a couple hours a day and then, put it away. Send the mix off to the band members, and then they'll give me their opinion, their tweaks, their comments, and they'll get back to me either by a phone conversation or by email.
How long does it take you to do a mix? And just figure all the time that you're putting in mixing, not the time that you're walking away from it. What does it take you? Is it about the same when it's all said and done as when you used to do it on a console?
Bobby, it probably is around the same. It's probably like a day's work.
Yeah.
12, probably overall about 12, 14 hours, which is probably what it used to take in the old days. I used to go in it like, I used to work 12 hour days. So you get the mix and then listen to it overnight and then tweak it in the morning.
Yeah.
And,
standard for everybody basically back then.
Yeah. And, a little bit of a setback or maybe a good thing, if you're finished with something 2 weeks ago, and then all of a sudden one of the band members says, "You know what? That one little part. Yes. we're gonna master next week, but can you go back in and, just bring that rhythm guitar up in the second verse at, minute 20, that kind of thing."
Yes, I've gone through that recently myself. Actually,
yeah.
Well, this has been very cool. Let me ask you one more question. So, what was the best piece of business advice that you ever got or learned?
Trust your instinct. That's my motto. Yeah, trust your instinct. I think that it's not what you learn or what you see or what you do. You just have to. I think it probably can say this for any type of business is just believe in yourself and what you're doing and that it's the right thing. And to trust your instinct, your first, usually my first reaction to something is the true reaction.
I was just going to ask you if that's the case, if you feel like whatever comes to you first is going to be best.
It usually is. It's hard for me to judge myself. I just kind of go for it all the time. I don't ponder things. I won't spend, a day getting a kick drum sound. I just kind of go for it. I always have. And it's just trust your instinct. My schooling was listening to, Beatles records and the radio and listening to Led Zeppelin records. And,
I know what you mean.
And I find if I'm working on a mix or working with something, if I'm still liking what I'm doing, on the project, then that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. So, but if you fall into a point where This is. I'm not happy about this, and doing something wrong.
I'm sure you work with the artists like this who have too many ideas, and they'll do the first thing, and then they'll go, "Oh, let's do a reggae version of that." No, okay. No, you know what? Let's change this now. And you go around circles, and it just gets different, and never gets better. And it's like, no. You were right the first time.
It's true. And, you know, I'm guilty of that as well. I can give you a classic example of that. When I was working on the first Living Color record, and we were doing the guitar solo for Cult of Personality. We set up, we had just finished all the backing guitars. And then, you know, Vernon was in the control room. We were at Sound on Sound when it was, I don't even remember where it was, the original Sound on Sound studios. It might have been it was on 48th Street. Don't recall. Vernon came in. He did the solo, and they're like, "Okay, try another one, try another one, and try another one." You know, and we kept all of them. Yeah. I did like six of them, and you know, sure enough, which one do we use? The first one.
Yeah, right.
No comping, no nothing, and you know, I'm guilty of that as well. And that was with tape. So now you have, you know, all these. Sometimes, I mean, you know, I've sent a couple of projects back because people want me to comp things like that. You know, when I'm not doing the production,
yeah,
you know, I'll get like a session comes in and there's like, you know, 10 tracks of a guitar solo. And I call a person up and said, "Well, what's these 10 tracks of guitar? Oh, that's your mixing. When you're mixing, you'll figure that out, won't you?" I'm like, "No, I don't. That's not what I do." And you know, on the same session, there was also, you know, 20 tracks of vocals and mixing. That's what you do for mixing. You figure out all those vocals. I said, "No, it's not. I'm sorry."
Yeah. And no one realizes how much time that takes. I mean, now here's the other thing. Do you do a lot of prepping when you get something in that you don't produce or you don't record? Because what I find is I'll get something in and I'll be finding clicks and pops and noises and all sorts of stuff that it'll take me a day to go in and fix everything and edit it. And it's like, oh, man.
Absolutely. I just got something. I'm working on this little, it's a Christmas project. By a band that was well known in the 80s. And I got that thing in, and there are just noises and pops and clicks and vocal trails and little pieces of vocal and hums and guitar noises. You know, I was always incredibly careful to even, you know, way back when, you know, 35 years ago, I would, if there was noise between guitars, I would bring the fader down or I would erase it. I would spot erase.
Yeah.
There was never anything. No kind of extraneous noise on any of my tracks personally.
Yeah.
You know, I just had to spend a couple days cleaning up stuff, just as you mentioned. And boy, what are people thinking?
I have no idea, but it makes me crazy because, again, people don't realize the amount of time that goes into really tightening something up.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, finishing the editing, it's like, well, why didn't you do this before you gave me the tracks?
Yeah. And also, on this particular song, there was also a gazillion backing vocal tracks, like a gazillion, and like, you know, like one part on one track, one part on the other track, and then on a couple of the tracks, there's, you know, there's this little soft, tiny, quiet part that goes like this, and then all of a sudden there's this screaming and yelling part, you know. So you have to, like, you know, cut and take that out, make another track, you know, put it somewhere else, and it's just fixing other people's stuff.
And that's part of what we do now, huh?
It isn't. Well, not if I can help it. But.
Well, it's what's expected anyway, unfortunately. Yeah. Yeah. Ed, this has been great. I always enjoy talking to you. Always. It's always a lot of fun, and I always learn a lot. So thanks for doing this. I really do appreciate it.
Sure, Bobby. It's fun. I always learn something about myself when I do one of these chats.
That is perfect. Thanks, man.
Okay, buddy.
If you want to find out more about Ed, go to edstasium.com. That's edstasium.com, edstasium.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. That's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. And he helps put this together, and he does a great job. And thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.